Good afternoon and welcome. Today we celebrate Kim Ford Mazrui's appointment as the Mortimer M. Kaplan Professor of Law. This is perhaps one chair lecture in which the chair needs no introduction. Mort Kaplan is a legend in these walls and within the broader world. A member of the class of 1940, Mort graduated first in his class and was editor-in-chief of the Law Review. His legal practice was interrupted by a stint in service in the Navy, including being a beachmaster on Omaha Beach during the D-Day landings. He served on the law school's faculty from 1950 until his appointment as Commissioner of Internal Revenue in 1961. After his government service, he and his former student, Doug Drysdale, of the class of 1953, formed the firm of Kaplan and Drysdale, where you can still find Mort most days counseling clients. The holder of the Kaplan chair, Kim Ford Mazrui, received both his BA and JD from the University of Michigan, where he was a notes editor for the Law Review and won an impressive number of prizes, including the Michigan equivalent of our Margaret Hyde Award. He clerked for Judge Cornelia Kennedy on the Sixth Circuit and practiced at Sidley and Austin before joining the law school faculty in 1996. He was the first director of the Center for Race and the Law from 2003 to 2010. Kim writes primarily in the area of equal protection theory and doctrine as it applies to race and sexual orientation. In describing Kim's scholarship, the first word that comes to mind is courageous. He's not afraid to take positions at odds with prevailing orthodoxy and that cannot be fit neatly into a pre-existing ideological box. This was true beginning with his first published work, which examined law and policy relating to the adoption of African-American children. There were and are advocacy groups arguing passionately that African-American children should be matched only with African-American adoptive parents. Kim waded into an emotionally charged debate and brought to it remarkable analytical clarity. First, he noted that the underlying issue is culture, not race. It is not a meaningful statement to refer to someone being raised black or raised white if by those terms we refer only to skin color. We can only make sense of the debate if it is about the attitudes the child will develop about his or her race and the cultural experiences the child will have. Kim went on to make another point that is logically compelling, but no less controversial for that. He notes that while it can be important from a societal perspective to maintain a distinctly African-American culture, it is not necessarily in the best interests of any given African-American child to do so at any cost, particularly at the cost of giving up other advantages to be had from being adopted by a particular set of parents. The work for which Kim is best known, however, is on jury selection. When we speak of juries, casually, we use language like a jury of his peers or a representative jury that suggests that a jury reflect the makeup of the community from which it is drawn. But that is not the result the Equal Protection Clause, the principal avenue of regulation of jury selection practices, requires. Kim therefore makes an intriguing policy proposal that draws on the theory and practice of legislative districting. He suggests that a jurisdiction divide itself into districts for purposes of jury selection and that those districts follow common legislative districtive practices, paying attention to commonalities of race, socioeconomic status, and so on, so that the districts are to some extent communities of interest. A jury would then be selected with representation from each district, ensuring that the jury will, to some extent, reflect the divergent populations within the jurisdiction. Kim's proposal has gained traction in the real world. Lawyers and policymakers within both Illinois and Kansas have proposed adopting a plan modeled on it. Kim's scholarship frequently touches on core equal protection concerns such as affirmative action and same-sex marriage. This afternoon, he will discuss potential policy responses to racial disparities in economic, health, and social outcomes, and the constitutional questions they raise. I have no doubt he will approach the topic with his characteristic willingness to consider both sides of a debate and to steer that debate from the emotional to the analytical realm. Please join me in welcoming the Mortimer M. Kaplan Professor of Law, Kim Ford Mazrui.
Thank you very much, Dean Mahoney, for that very kind introduction. And thank you all for being here this afternoon, especially on Halloween. It is such a great honor to be appointed the Mortimer Kaplan Chair. Professor Kaplan's generosity to this law school community is truly ubiquitous, including this magnificent Kaplan Pavilion in which we sit today. Let me also take this opportunity to thank my wife, Kay, for being here, and my mother and her husband, Jim, for driving all the way from Michigan for this event. No pressure. And let me also take this opportunity to thank the law school community for welcoming my wife, Kay, my son, Will, and me to Charlottesville 17 years ago, and the support you've given us throughout our time here. Let me just see if I can get this out of my... Okay. Okay, the journey I invite you on today is entitled The Canary Blind Constitution: Must Government Ignore Racial Inequality? And my talk raises two puzzles, one medical and one legal. The medical, or public health puzzle, is what are the causes of racial disparities in health, and what can be done to address those causes? The federal government and every state invests enormous amounts of resources researching this question, and the quote I have behind me is a statement of the guiding principle of the Center for Disease Control Office of Minority Health, which is to reduce race disparities in health to improve the health of the entire nation. Now, why the interest in health disparities, and in particular, I want to talk about racial disparities in infant mortality. Well, infant mortality, first of all, of course, is a tragedy. Any infant dying in its first year of life is a tragedy, and 25,000 infants die in the United States alone every year. Second interest in infant mortality rates is that infant mortality serves as a signal regarding the overall health and well-being of a community. Policymakers, researchers, government agencies routinely look at infant mortality rates as a gauge for how well the population is doing in terms of economics, nutrition, the environment, government, democracy or oppression, war, tend to be reflected in infant mortality rates. And then also, the signal provided by infant mortality rates can serve as a guide to identifying underlying causes. And solving those causes or addressing those causes can be used to help everybody. And this is where the canary in the title of my talk comes in. Law professors Lonnie Guineer and Gerald Torres, in their book, The Miner's Canary, use the metaphor of the coal miner's canary. For centuries, coal miners took canary birds into the mine, and because their respiratory systems are more sensitive than humans, when they would show distress when toxicity levels became dangerous. So when the canary shows distress or dies, it's time to get out. And Guineer and Torres say we can analogize racial disparities to the canary in the mine, that racial disparities are a signal that there's some underlying cause that's systematically causing racial disparities, some social, economic, environmental cause, and that searching for the causes of the racial disparity can help to identify those causes for the benefit of everybody. So why do black infants in the United States die at 2 to 3 times the rate of white infants. And why has this ratio actually increased over the past 30 years, despite landmark advances in civil rights and advances in the quality and distribution of healthcare services? And if you control for socioeconomics, so for example, if you can compare middle-class black females to middle-class white females, the gap is actually larger than when you compare overall black females to overall black or white females. The gap goes up as you proceed up the economic ladder. And in fact, black women with graduate degrees have higher rates of infant mortality than white women without a high school diploma. And researchers have struggled to understand and explain racial disparities, and many factors have been looked into, such as things like income, education levels, other socioeconomic factors, access to healthcare, including prenatal care, utilization of healthcare, best sleeping practices. Many of these factors have been identified as causes of infant mortality, and they have been used to bring infant mortality rates down, and they have been brought down significantly over the past 30 years. But despite addressing these underlying causes, the ratio of black to white has not gone down and, in fact, has gone up. So researchers have puzzled as to what explains the racial gap. So some have suggested perhaps it's biology. Perhaps there are race-linked genes that explain the racial gap that perhaps cause poorer birth outcomes in black women. But this explanation has also been discounted. Some of the research has looked at first-generation African immigrants and compared their infant mortality rates with African-American immigrants and with white immigrants. And the thought was that if it's linked to race, then African immigrants would likely have even higher infant mortality rates because their racial stock is in some sense more pure. But what they found is that African immigrants have infant mortality rates much more comparable to white American females and significantly better than black American women who've been here for several generations. And in fact, those immigrant women, as you look at subsequent generations, the infant mortality rates go up. And this is true of Asian immigrants and Hispanic immigrants as well, that the first generation, this is controlling for socioeconomic status as well, the first generation have lower infant mortality rates than second and third generation. For white immigrants, it's the opposite. White mothers first generation immigrants have higher rates of infant mortality than the second or third generation. So there seems to be something about living in America for women of color that has detrimental effects on birth outcomes, such as, for example, premature birth or low birth weight. So the most recent hypothesis that has gained traction is stress. Not just the acute stress of pregnancy, but also chronic stress or the accumulation of stress over a lifetime. And that this stress, including from childhood, can have effects on birth outcomes. And the hypothesis is that black women are more likely to experience more stress than white women. And I'm primarily comparing black to white as the extreme examples. So one of the features of life that may be causing stress is discrimination. At least is hypothesized, experiencing discrimination, the perception of discrimination, the fear of discrimination, and also socioeconomic factors like living in high crime neighborhoods, financial stress, family dislocation, only with factors that don't show up when you just compare women when they're pregnant. So recall, when you compare middle class black and white women, there's a significant gap. In fact, it's approximately 3-1. But the idea is, middle-class, professional, affluent black women are more likely to be first generation into the middle class. So they're more likely to have grown up poor and experienced the stress associated with that experience. So many recent programs have incorporated stress as part of the effort to reduce infant mortality for everybody, such as the immediate impacts of stress, such as hypertension, and also preconception effects on stress, such as poor nutrition, financial stress, lack of childcare, lack of father involvement, providing counseling for women who may need it. And these are promising, but the jury is still out, and race disparities in infant mortality are still described as the persistent puzzle. Which leads me to the second puzzle, the legal puzzle. The legal puzzle is, does the Constitution permit the government to investigate and address the causes of racial disparities in health, in infant mortality? And by the Constitution, I want to clarify, I mean as interpreted by the Supreme Court. This project is looking at Supreme Court interpretations, not to endorse those interpretations, but to take them seriously and examine their implications. So here are three potential responses to racial disparities in infant mortality, and let me suggest their potential constitutional problems. One, provide stress care for black women to reduce the racial gap in infant mortality. Second, provide stress care for all women to reduce the racial gap in infant mortality. Third, provide stress care for all women to reduce infant mortality, period. So let me go through each, but my bottom line to guide you where I'm going is that the first is almost certainly unconstitutional. Number two is uncertain, but I will argue the logic of current constitutional law would probably hold it unconstitutional. The third, possibly, but I will argue that current law should uphold response number three. So to understand response number one's constitutional status, I need to explain the strict scrutiny test, which is what the Supreme Court applies to racial classifications. And strict scrutiny, by design, invalidates most laws unless they further some compelling governmental interest. They're to advance some very important government goal, and the racial classification is necessary to achieve that goal. And by racial classification, the court means a law that classifies people expressly by race, and then the result is that in administering the law, people are then treated differently on the basis of race. So the Civil War resulted in the Equal Protection Clause being added to the Constitution, but it was not applied with much rigor for 100 years. Segregation was upheld. And then by the mid to late 20th century, the Supreme Court started applying strict scrutiny to laws that classified by race, and the laws in question were laws that discriminated against African Americans. So the court applied this, and the result was every segregationist law was invalidated. For example, in Loving versus Virginia, 1967, the Supreme Court applied strict scrutiny to laws that prohibited interracial marriage, and the court said it failed the test, it's unconstitutional. It doesn't further a compelling interest, rather, it's designed to preserve white supremacy. What was uncertain at that time, in the late 1960s, was whether this strict scrutiny test would apply to racial classifications designed to benefit racial minorities. Such policies were unknown at the time. And both on and off the Supreme Court, the question was debated when affirmative action policies arose, race-based affirmative action policies that classify by race for the benefit of minorities. And those who would argue strict scrutiny should not apply to those kinds of policies argued for what's been called the anti-subordination theory of equal protection. This theory holds that the purpose of equal protection is to prevent a dominant, powerful majority from subordinating a politically weak minority. And laws that disadvantaged African Americans violated this anti-subordination principle, and so they were subject to strict scrutiny and struck down. But, they argued, laws that are designed to benefit racial minorities are different. We shouldn't be so skeptical of their validity, because here the dominant majority is disadvantaging itself. And so we can take a more lenient hand, we being the court, because we can presume that there's probably a legitimate reason for the discrimination, when the majority discriminates, in a sense, against itself in favor of the minority, which is what race-based affirmative action does. In contrast to the anti-subordination theory is the anti-classification theory. And the anti-classification theory holds that the purpose of equal protection is to prohibit the government from classifying people by race. It presumes colorblindness on the part of the government. The idea being that race is irrelevant. It doesn't determine one's intelligence or moral character. So government generally should have no business classifying people by race. So we should be suspicious when the government is classifying people by race, regardless of which race is being benefited or burdened, because it's irrelevant regardless of which race. So that policy, that principle, was ultimately adopted by the Supreme Court in 1989. After over a decade of disagreement on the Supreme Court, a majority coalesced around the anti-classification approach, and now holds, per the second quotation I have, that all racial classifications are to be reviewed under strict scrutiny, even those that benefit a racial minority. So applying that to response number one, this is a form of race-based affirmative action in the sense that it's a racial classification designed to benefit a racial minority. It classifies women by race, black women, and then provides stress care only to those women to reduce the racial gap in infant mortality. So this would be subject to strict scrutiny, and that fact alone means it's probably going to be unconstitutional. But perhaps there are two ways to uphold it under strict scrutiny. First, isn't reducing infant mortality a compelling governmental interest? Surely it is. But, the court would likely hold, the use of race is not necessary to reduce infant mortality. To the contrary, by limiting the benefit to black women, you're not helping white women who might also benefit from stress care or some other benefit to reduce infant mortality. So the racial classification is not necessary. It fails the strict scrutiny test. Another potential justification would be, well, what about making up for the effects of historic racial discrimination? So presumably, racial disparities in society, including in infant mortality, reflect, at least to a substantial degree, the systematic discrimination against African Americans throughout our history. And so the only way to remedy those consequences is to now favor allocating benefits to African Americans in order to undo or remedy the effects of discrimination. And that's a common understanding of one of the purposes of affirmative action. The Supreme Court has acknowledged the legitimacy of, and in fact the compelling nature of trying to remedy discrimination. But the court says you have to identify it with particularity. It's not enough to just point to racial statistics, even if they plausibly result from historic discrimination or what the Supreme Court calls societal discrimination, the discrimination that was pervasive throughout our society. That's not enough. To use racial classifications, you need to be more precise, identify the time, manner, and actors involved as much as practicable to ensure that the use of race is limited to the extent necessary. And this would not be satisfied because the kinds of discrimination that black women experience in their life, or which black Americans experienced in prior generations, which are reflected today in economic disparities, are undocumented. One simply cannot identify them with particularity. So strict scrutiny would strike down response number two. So what about response number one. What about response number two? Stress care for all women to reduce the racial gap in infant mortality. This is certainly more promising. Here, you're providing the benefit for white and black and other races. To understand how the court might approach this, understand this as what I call race-neutral affirmative action. And what I mean by that is it's race-neutral in the policy it uses. It does not classify women by race. So it's race neutral. It asks just, are you a woman? Perhaps are you of childbearing years? Or are you pregnant? But it still has an affirmative action purpose, by which I mean a purpose to benefit racial minorities. And let me explain why, because you might say, well, it's just designed to reduce the racial gap. It's not designed to favor black women. But logically, that's inherent in trying to reduce the racial gap. So to understand this, imagine reversing the races. So if you were designing it to reverse the gap, to raise the gap, let's do something to increase the racial gap, that would probably strike you as odd and troubling and would be a means of benefiting white women more than black women. But more than to intuition, logically, in order to reduce the racial gap, you have to reduce not just the numbers of black women, you have to reduce their percentages compared to the percentage of the rates for white women in order for the gap to go down. So it necessarily intends to reduce the proportion of infant mortality among black women more than white women. So it has that affirmative action intention. Well, the debate in the literature and in the courts is uncertain on this question. Do race-neutral classifications designed to benefit racial minorities trigger the strict scrutiny test? And it's uncertain. I weighed in on the debate early on about 12 years ago, and I argued that the logic of current doctrine would subject race-neutral policies that benefit racial minorities to strict scrutiny. And again, the intuition is, think of reversing the races. So imagine adopting a race-neutral policy to favor whites. So for example, if stress care were limited to married women, married white women are more likely to be married when they have children. And then assume that the purpose behind limiting the benefit to married women would be to favor white women, to disproportionately allocate the benefit to white women. Even though married black women would get the benefit, unmarried white women would not. If the purpose is to disproportionately benefit white women, and it would have that effect, then that would be understood as discriminatory against African Americans. And in addition, again, to your intuition, we know the law would so hold. And we know this because of prior cases in which the Supreme Court has invalidated race-neutral classifications that were designed to favor whites over racial minorities. Literacy tests and poll taxes were struck down, even though they're race neutral, designed to burden African American access to voting. Or the University of Mississippi raised its SAT score cutoff for admission in order to favor admitting white applicants over black applicants. And the Supreme Court said, nice try, a race neutral classification designed to discriminate is still discrimination, and it has to be subject to the strict scrutiny test. So that's one line of doctrine that just deals with laws that were designed to harm minorities. And then we have another line of cases that I've already mentioned involving express racial classifications designed to benefit minorities, the race-based affirmative action cases. And there the court says the Equal Protection Clause is symmetrical It protects all races equally, at least for purposes of subjecting them to strict scrutiny. So racial classifications that benefit minorities get that same test. So when you put these two lines together, race-neutral classifications designed to harm minorities are subject to strict scrutiny. Express racial classifications designed to benefit are subject to strict scrutiny. It logically follows then that race-neutral classifications designed to benefit racial minorities would be viewed by the court as still discrimination, even though using race-neutral means, and still discriminatory, even though designed to benefit racial minorities. So that would result in subjecting number two to strict scrutiny as a form of race-neutral affirmative action. Now, I've also argued that race-neutral policies should satisfy strict scrutiny more often than express racial classifications. But strict scrutiny is strict by design, so one should always put their money on the law being struck down. And the court applying it would likely strike it down for the same reasons that it struck down number two. Even though you're benefiting all women, your goal is to disproportionately favor the benefit for African Americans. That's not necessary, nor have you identified the discrimination of the past with adequate particularity to satisfy that justification. So number two would probably be struck down, but the Supreme Court has yet to address that specific question, so we'll just have to see. Which takes us to number three. Stress care for all women to reduce infant mortality, period. That seems unassailable. There's no race in the means, and there's no racial purpose. So what could be troubling about that? The problem is when you widen the time frame. Recall that the discovery of stress as a causal factor in contributing to infant mortality was an investigative process that began by inquiring into what's causing the racial gap in infant mortality. So there was a race-related motivation that began the process, and but for that racial motivation, we wouldn't have identified stress care and produced this policy. And some read the court as applying strict scrutiny whenever government decision-making is motivated by race. Policies that just have a racial effect are not subject to strict scrutiny, but if the policy was motivated by race, then it's subject to strict scrutiny. Other phrases are if it's because of race, if it was caused by race, or as some scholars have said, if it's race dependent, the decision-making process depended in some way on race. And under this conception, response number three is also based on race, because race motivated the initial inquiry, so it would be subject to strict scrutiny. And certainly a strict colorblind approach could support striking this down or at least subjecting it to strict scrutiny, because if government's really supposed to be colorblind, absent some extraordinary justification, then government wouldn't see racial disparities in order to investigate them. But here I want to argue that even under current law, response number three should be upheld. And this is by distinguishing between the discriminatory use of race and the evidentiary use of race. It's the discriminatory use of race that triggers strict scrutiny when pursued through race-neutral means. And a more careful understanding of the discriminatory purpose is that it's when the policy was adopted with the purpose at the time of its adoption, concurrently, it was adopted with the purpose of affecting one racial group more than another. So recall the University of Mississippi raising its SAT score. It said, let's raise the score because of the purpose, because of the effect it will have. That was part of the objective, that was part of the goal. And that's a discriminatory purpose, and I've already argued that I think that would likely apply even when the purpose is to benefit racial minorities, like in response number two. But the evidentiary use of race is a use of race at an earlier point in the decision-making process and with a different purpose. It's at the initial investigative stage, the fact-finding stage, and the purpose is informational in nature. It's to diagnose the underlying causes of the racial disparity. It's not about adopting a policy with a particular effect. It's about determining facts, understanding the causes. And that need not be followed by a discriminatory purpose. It could be if they then later purposely adopt a policy because of its effect on race, but it need not. That use of race precedes the adoption of the policy, precedes how the information discovered is used. But if the information discovered is non-racial in nature and used without regard to benefiting one racial group more than another, then there would be no discriminatory purpose to trigger the strict scrutiny test. So recall the miner's canary metaphor. The idea would be that the canary's distress is a signal to identify underlying toxic environment. But that signal is informational only. What you do with that signal is a different matter. So as applied to infant mortality, the idea would be the stage of investigating the causes is merely using race as an evidentiary signal into what might be going underneath, using race perhaps to determine what it's correlated with as a fact-finding process. And support for this characterization can be seen in the trial process, in legislative fact-finding, and in government agency research. In the trial process, race as evidence is routinely used without any suggestion that it should be subject to strict scrutiny. This is most evident in race discrimination cases. So if an employee sues an employer, the employee will produce evidence, in most cases, of the racial composition of the employer's workforce, of the racial effect of the employer's hiring policy, comparing the race and credentials of the employee with those of other people who were hired over him or her. And the other side will introduce racial evidence designed to dispel the allegation of race discrimination. Similarly, in affirmative action cases, currently Abigail Fisher is suing the University of Texas, and part of her evidence is racial. She points to not only the use of race in the University of Texas's policy, but looks to how many people were benefited, Latinos and blacks, by the university's use of race, what the credentials of those particular people of those races are, and she also introduces the fact that she's Caucasian as part of her evidence. And the court's never suggested that that's problematic, and in fact, Justice Scalia, who's one of the staunchest colorblind proponents on the court, has expressly characterized the proper use of race in employment discrimination cases as an evidentiary tool to determine whether the employer has discriminated against. He says the racial impact of a hiring practice can properly be introduced as evidence of a discriminatory intent. His concern, though, is when the racial impact is used to establish as a matter of law that the employer discriminated. He says the employer should get to introduce other evidence, including racial evidence, to dispel the inference that the statistics create. So he says it should be used as an evidentiary tool only. And then with legislative fact-finding and government agency research, the political process widely accepts on both sides of the aisle forms of race in these processes, and the Supreme Court has, in cases where it's come across there, bench, so to speak, has endorsed such uses of race. In affirmative action cases, for example, the court has expressly encouraged the use of racial statistics by legislatures who are trying to determine whether they would be entitled to engage in affirmative action. And with respect to government agency research, the Supreme Court itself used racial statistics in arriving at its own conclusion. In a case called United States versus Armstrong, black defendants were charged with crack distribution, and they claim that the federal prosecutor's office for that jurisdiction was only prosecuting black defendants, even though they introduced statistical evidence to show that there were white defendants charged in state court in the same jurisdiction for crack distribution. So they said this prosecutor's office is discriminating by race. The trial court was actually sufficiently convinced and in fact dismissed the prosecution. Supreme Court reversed and reinstated the prosecution, and they said this evidence does not prove the prosecutor discriminated. They did not fault the introduction of that racial evidence, nor suggest it needed to satisfy strict scrutiny. They just said it wasn't sufficiently probative of a discriminatory purpose on the part of the prosecutor. And one of the evidence the court relied on was Sentencing Commission statistics about correlations between race and certain crimes. White people are more likely to do LSD and child pornography. Blacks are more likely to deal crack. And so they said, so the fact that there's a disproportionate impact on black defendants doesn't mean the prosecutor's doing the discriminating. It could be reflecting real crime rates. So they used racial evidence as their own evidence to arrive at their own conclusion. Before turning to my own conclusion, let me identify two corollaries to the evidentiary use of race that can help to clarify that this is not simply a clever means of engaging in race-neutral affirmative action. Some may think this is just a clever way of helping minorities and coming up with a way of doing so. Well, one way to clarify this is to give examples that would show that this is not exclusively a way of benefiting racial minorities. Again, reverse the racial groups as a useful test for whether something is discriminatory or not. Recall with race-neutral affirmative action, I said if you reverse the racial groups, race-neutral policies designed to favor whites seems discriminatory. Well, that's why I've argued that logically, when you try to favor blacks through race-neutral means, it's discriminatory, even though some have disagreed with that interpretation. So if you reverse the groups here, would I still say it doesn't have to satisfy strict scrutiny? Well, I have to be committed to that, and it turns out I am. So, but here's how it goes. Let me give you the first corollary, which is disparities that burden whites can be investigated through the evidentiary use of race, and if that information is used for non-racial purposes, it's not subject to strict scrutiny. Here are two examples. Whites are more likely to commit suicide than blacks. Secondly, whites diagnosed with heart disease are less likely to get proper medical treatment than blacks diagnosed with heart disease. That's puzzling. Why would either one be? Well, one hypothesis I've seen for suicide rates is that black American culture tends to involve more external extended family relationships and extended neighborhood relationships, including among the poor, as sociologists have documented. And the hypothesis is that those interactions mean blacks are, on average, less likely to experience the kind of isolation that could contribute to suicide for someone experiencing depression. With respect to heart disease, the hypothesis I've seen is that blacks are overall less healthy than whites. And so those who seek medical attention, and these are people who've been diagnosed with heart disease, blacks are more likely to also seek medical attention for other maladies. And so they're more likely to have their heart disease monitored and treated. Well, we've investigated the racial disparity. Here's non-racial information. It can be used for non-racial purposes, not for the purpose of benefiting whites, but for the purpose of benefiting anyone who might be susceptible to suicide or heart disease if encouraging social support for people who might be suicidal, or more frequent medical treatment for people diagnosed with heart disease. If that would benefit whites more than blacks, but that's not the purpose behind it, then it should not be subject to strict scrutiny, even though it was caused by investigating a racial disparity. The second corollary is disparities where that harm blacks, but where the underlying cause turns out to be useful in ways that support leaving it in place. So consider that a law school, a public university, so it's subject to the Constitution, admits a disproportionate number of whites among its applicants compared to black applicants. Inquire into the racial disparity. What's going on? What if it's determined, as is quite plausible, that the law school admission test, the LSAT, has a disproportionate effect against African-American applicants, and so giving weight to the LSAT results in admitting fewer blacks? Well, is that a problem? Some people have argued that it is, and the LSAT is a flawed test. But if it's not flawed, and I don't have the expertise to say so, but my colleague Alex Johnson knows more about the LSAT than probably anyone in the country, he has argued that the LSAT itself is not the problem. That the law school admission test is actually a very well-designed test. It's probably one of the best high-stakes tests out there for any kind of educational context. For its purpose, predicting first-year law school performance, it's actually a pretty good test. So if the test itself is genuinely useful for legitimate purposes, then the evidentiary use of race does not support eliminating it. So, well, the underlying problem does not have a non-racial justification for eliminating the cause. In fact, those who argue we should eliminate the LSAT because of its racial impact, they're the ones who might be subject to strict scrutiny. That might be a form of race-neutral affirmative action. You're eliminating the LSAT, which is a race-neutral policy change, but if it's for the purpose of increasing the admission of African Americans, that might be strict scrutiny as a form of race-based affirmative action. But if the non-racial reasons support keeping it, then the evidentiary use of race supports that result, even though the disparity burdens African Americans. So I began the legal puzzle with the question whether we, through our government, can investigate and address the causes of racial disparities, including in infant mortality, and this would apply to health more generally, and other factors like economic or educational disparities. I've suggested that there are three potential responses. Going up the screen, they become more problematic. The evidentiary use of race should be constitutional. Race-based affirmative action probably would be struck down, and race-based affirmative action, number one, would almost certainly be struck down. I want to conclude with the question whether we should. That is, whether we should, through our government, investigate and address the causes of racial disparities. And some may say no, and I don't just mean bigots. Some people of good faith may just genuinely believe that racial inequality is simply an inevitable feature of American society. A colleague and friend of mine, who's a psychologist and a scholar, studies the extent to which people are egalitarian-minded, they believe that people are essentially equal, or hierarchically-minded, that some people are better than others. And she has found that some people are racially hierarchical, that they believe that on average, some races are superior to others in their abilities. And in fact, her own college students have reflected this attitude. Some have said that they actually find it suspicious when they see blacks equally represented in positions of authority and power. That when there is proportional representation of African Americans, that the system must be rigged in some way. And to some degree, who can blame them? These are young people who've grown up in a world without government-imposed segregation, and yet they see racial inequality all around them. They could peer in the window of their high school hallway when they were in high school, and if almost all the students are white or Asian, it's probably advanced placement. They can go down the hall and peek in another room, and if almost all the students are black or brown, it's probably a remedial level class or detention hall. So their experience teaches them that racial inequality is normal, even natural. My claim is the contrary, that racial inequality is neither normal nor natural. And I base my claim on the same proposition that the Supreme Court relies on when it subjects racial classifications to strict scrutiny, namely, that race is irrelevant. If race is irrelevant, then racial inequalities suggest there's something amiss. If race is irrelevant, then black infants should not be more prone to die. Black children should not be more prone to fail out of school. Black adults should not be more prone to be poor, jobless, homeless, or serving time in prison. The fact that stark racial disparities persist across virtually every indicator of social and economic well-being signals, like the canary in the mine, that centuries of discrimination have entrenched inequalities that tend to perpetuate themselves from one generation to the next. And these inequalities mean unequal access to the types of resources and opportunities that are necessary for people to have fulfilling lives. If the Constitution is supposed to promote equality, then surely it doesn't mandate ignoring inequality. If anything, it should mandate addressing inequality. But at a minimum, it should permit the government to address inequality. The Constitution does not mandate ignoring the canary in the mine. The Constitution is not canary blind. Thank you very much. Thank you very much. Thank you.